There are many good stories about Gwen Parle, but he can tell them better than I can. So he's got one part of the professor at Princeton, and I think he's a real OR person. He's solo of the inform, so this is as real OR as it gets. And the director of the Castle lab, and in this lab they actually do solve real problems. So they solve large stochastic optimization problems, and have some pretty neat applications in transportation, in health, energy, and finance. And recently authored the book Approximate Dynamic Programming, Solving the Curse of Dimensionality, which you could all have on your desk. And I have lots of good stories about Warren, and he can tell them they're much better than I can. But I just want to tell that he's a baseball fan, an avid one. Unfortunately, a Yankees fan. Unfortunately, it's last year. I'm a Red Sox fan, so we get a chance to laugh once in a while. So without further ado, please, I want to welcome Warren Parle. Thank you.
Thanks, Shai. This is really a great honor. I appreciate Rich's invitation, the organizers. It's a lot of fun for me coming over from the operations research community to talk to an audience like this because there's so few people in OR who sit and think about the issues that are fairly routine to a group like this. I also appreciate Shai not getting in a dig that the Yankees remain totally defeated by the Red Sox this year, but we'll beat them eventually. So Rich had asked that we give a little bit of history, and so I dug back through some old PowerPoint presentations. I got my start with this industry called truckload trucking. Now, truckload trucking is taxi cabs for freight. You call up this company, they send you the whole truck, you fill up the whole truck, you give them a load of freight, the truck drives from A to B, the load goes away, and now as a trucking company, I have to figure out what to do with the truck. Okay, so I am the company managing this whole fleet of trucks. Now, back in the 1980s, so I got my career started around 1981, computers were pretty slow there. This was before the internet. But it wasn't before optimization models were being used. So our basic optimization problem in trucking is you have a bunch of drivers, let's say four drivers on the right, three loads on the left. And the challenge is to figure out what drivers to assign to which loads so that we can maximize profits over time. And we have a problem at a point in time, and we have problems over time. So as time evolves, new drivers come in and enter the system, new loads are called in, equipment breaks down, people are delayed. Now, we can optimize at a point in time. And if you go to the late 1970s, 1970s was a breakthrough in operations research. Okay, so computers were creaky, linear programming codes virtually non-existent, but there was this great breakthrough on network algorithms. And if you could formulate your problem as a network, we had really fast algorithms, and these were pure networks. Now, optimizing at a point in time was the big breakthrough, and the first company I talked to, Schneider National, had such an algorithm in to do real-time optimization. The challenge was optimizing over time. When these trucks take loads, the loads can be hundreds of miles long and thousands of miles long. A typical movement will be anywhere from 1 to 4 days to complete the move. And you have to think about where the driver is going to be at the destination load. You even want a driver there. Is that a good place to pick up new loads? Is that a good place to have that particular driver? Now, back in the old days, this is the mental image we had, time-space networks. So you have space and you have time. The dark is a loaded move. The dashed line is empty moves because sometimes you have too many trucks in one location. You have to move them out empty. And this was the view. And this one company I was talking to, Schneider National, had such a model built. They solved it, I don't know, once a day. They would go out days in the future, plan things. So in 1982, a classmate of mine had gone out to work at Schneider. His boss, a fellow by the name of Mike Crow, had a master's in operations research. And he came in charge of marketing, and he knew about OR and optimization, and he knew what the word stochastic meant. Oh, my gosh. And my former colleague, close friend Woody Richardson, says, hey, you're going back to Philadelphia. You've got to have dinner with my friend Warren Powell. He's a bright guy. So I sit with Mike Crow over dinner, and I had one of these career-changing dinner conversations. Mike said, look, we've got this model that looks into the future. This is days in the future. In truckload trucking, people will call in, hey, can you pick up my load this afternoon or tomorrow, maybe 2 days out. They just don't book very much in advance. It's sort of a what can you do for me tomorrow type of thing. And Mike posed the question for me, what kind of a discount could we give if we could get the shippers to just call a few days in advance? And I sat there and my first reaction is, wow, what a great question. But not only did I not know the answer, much more distressingly, I didn't know how to think about the problem. You know what it's like to have a problem where you don't even know how to think about it? The beauty of optimization, if the problem's deterministic, is that you know how to think about it. There's a framework to write it down. We know what to do. We can put it on a sheet of paper. We can code algorithms. If we can't solve everything, at least we know what we're working on. When you go to make the problem stochastic, you really are struggling. So the 1980s, to make a long story short, was sort of my lost decade where I stumbled around trying to figure out how to make the stochastic. I tried all kinds of algorithms, one of which was Markov decision processes. So here's a very old slide of mine. Imagine that we've divided the country into a 5x5 grid. And if I had one truck running around the country, you know, he has 25 states. And he can sit there and bounce around the 25 states. What if I have two trucks? Well, now I start getting this permutations and combinations stuff. If I have five trucks, they can go all these things. There's actually a formula that if you have a certain number of trucks bouncing around a certain number of locations, you do this, choose this, and that'll tell you how many states are in the system. So let's take a peek at how big this number gets. So if you have one truck, this is locations. If you have up to 1,000 locations, you have 1,000 states. If you have five trucks and 1,000 locations, you're up to 8 billion. But if you have 50 trucks, it gets to be a very big number. By the way, I was incredibly impressed that Excel would compute that number. And that's about as big as it will go. Now, the first company I was working with back then, so even though Schneider National approached it, Schneider's one of the big three mega truckload carriers. Back in those days, they were the biggest and remained the biggest up until a few years ago. The company I was working with, North American Van Lines, had 500 trucks. And by the end of this talk, I'm going to talk to you about a project we did with Schneider where this number is 7,000 and this number is, you know, in the many millions. So, now, no joke. So you can just say, well, that's just a bad model. That's a bad formulation. There was a student at the University of Michigan doing Markov decision processes, heard about my work, called me up and says, wow, that sounds great. Did his whole PhD dissertation on this. Pretty much had the dissertation done, calls me up and says, well, give me a rough idea what the numbers are like. And so I had no idea what he had done in his dissertation. So I started saying, well, our basic problem is about 500 trucks in 100 regions. And the phone goes silent. And I'm like, he's not saying anything. I'm like, oh, my God. I bet he did it as an MVP, which he did. Okay. So, you know, there are people who do this. Advanced 10 years, 1990, Yellow Freight System. The largest less-than-truckload motor carrier. I had done a big consulting project with them in the 80s. They asked me to do the operational problem. How do they optimize the flows of their drivers? And they had about, 10,000 drivers and whatnot. I still had this view of time space networks, but the drivers are not all the same. Before, when we did trucking, a truck was a truck, and we call that single commodity flow. This was drivers. And the problem is the drivers come in different flavors, and you end up with something the OR community calls multi-commodity flow. Not just multi-commodity flow, integer multi-commodity flow. There are people still researching this problem. This is still considered one of the hard algorithmic problems that people work on. And the annoying thing here is that that's a simplification of the real problem. But okay, well, let's live with this for a while. So we actually built a system that would project out. This button here says go out 4 hours, go out 8 hours, go out 16, go out 24. Too much red here says too many drivers projected over the next 24 hours or whatever. Green says too many loads. What they want to do is get all the color out. That means everything's balanced. I have 10 drivers and 10 loads. Boom, match them up. Too much red says I'm going to have 15 drivers away from home. They might have to come back empty. Now, so we built this one system. We were heroes at Yellow. But it was the painful truth that our optimization model never worked. And I actually went in absolutely convinced that with all the heuristics and engineering and, you know, hell, I can be a good engineer, the optimization model never worked. They liked all the other stuff we built. The optimization model never worked. And even though we moved on with the relationship and they liked all the software we built, I kept going back to the lab going, darn, that was a hard problem. How do they solve that problem? And I would do something that's very familiar to this community. I would watch the humans. Okay? The standard OR strategy is to go over here and build a big math model. Oh my God, this is really hard. I need powerful algorithms, fast machines, whatnot. I got to tell you, that problem was so hard, and we had come nowhere near actually modeling the true problem. I kept going and watching the humans. What do the humans do? And I'd be in their dispatch room, and I'd find, you know what? They don't solve this whole problem. They solve a problem at a point in time, and they approximate the future. They just have a rough idea where the system will be in the future. They're basically here and now, and they're going to step, oops, they're going to step forward in time. They roll forward. I'm like, oh, I can do that too. So this is a very familiar story in the ADPRL community, which is, well, let's look at what the human does and go do that. So that's what I did. And my algorithmic breakthroughs in the 1990s was to say, gee, I can just simulate through. Now, in hindsight, this doesn't even look very deep, but it was a big breakthrough back then. And funny thing is, I actually moved forward, and we would do this with iterative learning. I actually moved very quickly from yellow. The funny thing is, by the time I figured out how to solve the problem, they had moved on. They liked all the other stuff that we had built. But the railroads approached me, and I'll come back to this, but Norfolk Southern has been probably my biggest user of proximate dynamic programming, both for the locomotive and the freight cars. And I'll come back to that later. We moved on from locomotives to truckload trucking. It took Schneider 20 years. From 1982, when they first gave me the problem, in 2003, they gave me a project. And we actually got a project to, not to do real-time, but to do planning, and I'll come back to that one. We've moved on to NetJets as well. So it's not all trucks and trains, it's planes. No joke, I actually had somebody come up to me and says, now, Warren, what is it that you do? Is it trucks or trains, you know? Okay. Well, and so we're doing approximate dynamic programming for NetJets, very similar to these other companies. NetJets is run by a control center. And our job, there's a problem of how to do this in real time, and there's a problem that we're actually working on, which is how to simulate it. And once again, I want to behave like this group of people. And that's a theme that will keep coming back, is I've got a room full of people. Forget the trucks, trains, and planes. It's a room full of dispatchers, and I want to mimic them. I want to be as smart as that room full of people. So again, a very common theme in RL is, how do I mimic humans? How do I learn from humans? What's going on in that brain? What is that brain doing? How do I learn from that? I have a room full of humans I want to be like. And I've learned some neat things about this. I'll come back to these later. Another ADP application is with Embraer. They just came up with a new line of jets and they had to manage their spare parts, 4,000 spare parts. The main focus was high-value spare parts. You got engines, you got wings, but you've got nuts and bolts and tires. And we actually have a production system. Everything I'm telling you about are companies where we have production systems working at the company. So, and then we recently got into energy. And if I have time and if you allow me to keep speaking quickly, I'll be able to tell you about my energy project at the very end of the talk. And I'm going to develop a certain theme, and then I'm going to show you how I'm taking sort of the same basic algorithmic strategy and applying it over and over again. And somebody sort of feel like I should be starting a company here somewhere because everything here is done through the university. So let me give you an overview of how we've approached this. And I'm trying to give you both a sense of the history of how I stumbled into this, but then there'll be a little element of, well, here's how I figured it out and here's how I think about it. I'm not going to do much math, but I do need just a little notation, okay, so that if I put up the variable S for state, you have to have some sense of what I mean by that. So very briefly, first of all, pretty much everything I'm talking to you can be described as resource allocation. Now, that's a massive problem class. Technically, playing chess is a resource allocation problem, although we don't think of it that way. When I model truck drivers, I don't model a truck driver in CDI. I model a truck driver with a big vector of attributes. In fact, I like to use this attribute notation because my resources can be simple or complicated. And the attribute of a resource can be a couple of attributes or a lot. Think of A as a state variable, a state of a single entity. And when I do truck drivers for Schneider, it's 15 dimensions. So the number of attributes gets very large. Now, I'll use some basic notation. A will be the attribute of a single resource, the state of a single resource. The key variable here is this one. R sub TA is the number of resources with attribute A. You're going to see this from time to time. Every time you see R sub T, it's a vector. It's a big vector, okay? I don't talk about high dimensional as 5 or 10 or 80 dimensions. These are anywhere from a few thousand dimensions for a small problem to effectively infinite dimensional for very large problems, okay? Now, in the resource allocation world, we use resources to serve customers, demands, tasks, that sort of thing. I'll have a parallel notation. I'm not going to do very much with that, but you can just say in parallel, if A is the attribute of a driver, and this is how many drivers I have with this attribute, B is the attribute of a load, and that's the customer demand for how many loads of that type I have. So let me not spend too much time with that. Now, we have our state variable. Our system state variable consists of resources, customer demands, and for many years, that was my state variable. That's all I ever worked with until a few years ago I started doing energy modeling. And energy modeling got really messy because it came in with this third thing that I'll call state of the world, rho. Now, don't you just love math? Math is great. With one letter, I can have a little swoop and describe everything from state of technology, climate, weather, government policies, market prices. Isn't that just gorgeous? Don't we just love this? Math is great. How can you not like math? So when you see S, there's three views of the state of the system. One is the state of a single resource. One is the vector of all of my resources, and one is the state of the world. The fourth level has state of belief. Let me not get into that, okay? So now most of my transportation problems, this is the key variable. In my energy problem, this is what's causing us a lot of pain and heartache right now. Now, X. Every time you see X, it's a vector, assigning drivers to loads, assigning dispatching energy from wind turbines to electric power demands. These can be buying, selling, transforming, investing, moving, cleaning, whatever you want, but it tends to be fairly high-dimensional vector. We think of 200 dimensions as a toy problem that undergrads do in their sophomore linear programming class. My problem's a small problem. We'll start with X's in a few hundred dimensions and get up to maybe 10 to 50,000 dimensions. I don't really deal with problems where X at a point in time is much bigger than 50,000. But 50,000, we'll hit 50,000. W, I'm just going to wave my hand and call W my random variable. This is my Hurricane Katrina taking up my windmills. This is D hat is my random demands for loads. And rho hat is changes in climate, technology, policy, anything random. Let's call it W. Okay. There's my transition function. Now, this is something that's very totally routine to the control theory community. OR people don't use this notation. You know, the notion that you have some function that says, give me a state, give me an action, give me new information, here's a new state, we just don't use that vocabulary. That's weird and arcane. And a close friend of mine, Suvajit Sen, who's a top-flight applied mathematician doing stochastic programming, is writing a paper saying, well, I really like that control theory notation. Oh, well, that means I have to use X for state and U for control and that crazy control theory notation. But whatever. It's actually a very powerful device. It doesn't sound like anything big, but for OR people, it's actually sort of different. We don't use this. And then I'll just very briefly say that our goal here is to find a policy. We use the word policy. I'll often use this function X superscript pi. X is a function indexed by pi. Decision function and policy I use interchangeably. But what I like to do is to make it clear it is a function, and we have to go find the function. So, and we're going to, there's a lot of ways to do that, but in this audience, it's ADP or reinforcement learning. So now I've mathematically stated my problem. So I've got states, actions, information, and objective function. Now, let me talk about how we solve this using approximate dynamic programming. And I'm going to introduce this concept called the post-decision state variable. Now, when we start off wanting to solve these problems, we're familiar with Bellman's equation. Now, if you're a reinforcement learning person, you're a little bit more comfortable when I put an A in there. I like to develop the sense that these are just not different variables for the same thing, but they actually mean something different. When I read reinforcement learning papers, A is almost always a discrete action, sometimes a continuous, but if it's continuous, it's usually a scalar or a very low-dimensional scalar. And that most of the time, well, not all the time, but sometimes they're discretizing. But when I do X, every time you see X, I want you to think big vector. Okay? Now, if you go to the OR community, there's not a lot of people who use Bellman's equation. There's a community over here doing Markov decision processes, and they're mainly just proving theorems, okay, because we all know you can't use Bellman's equation, right? Okay, I mean, this stuff doesn't actually work. But if you want to do some serious stuff, oh, you have to do stochastic programming, And there's this community called Stochastic Programming. Now, they're the ones who do the real large problems and the serious work. A friend of mine whose PhD dissertation was on Markov decision processes, who then converted to stochastic programming, took me aside and said, NDP is just applied Markov chains. There's nothing serious going on there. So we all know that the reason you can't use this is the curse of dimensionality. You can frighten away dynamic programmers by putting up the curse. I was sitting at a table at a conference, and somebody leans over and says, oh, my boss likes dynamic programming. I don't do that stuff. Curse of dimensionality. I mean, I'm telling you, it is absolutely ingrained. This stuff doesn't work. Well, the news is actually worse than this, because really there's three curses. We have the state space. If S is a vector, we have a curse of dimensionality in the states. We have the outcome space. You can't actually compute that expectation, right? I mean, we can't really do that. And, of course, X is a vector, so the action space. So we have three curses of dimensionality. That's why the subtitle of my book is called Solving the Curses of Dimensionality. So I've taken what was an intractable problem and made it hopelessly intractable. There are three computational problems we have here. What's the value function? Where did I get that from? You know, if S is discrete and I can enumerate it, I can estimate it, whatnot. But so the value function is hard, and we all understand that. But let's momentarily take away the issue of the state variable. Let's get rid of it. Let's say I don't have a problem. Let's say I have what's called a one-stage problem. I don't have to roll forward in time. I have an X and an E. Those two don't mix. There's an entire community called stochastic search that deals with when you're minimizing or maximizing over a vector value decision with an embedded expectation. Now, if you can compute the expectation, fine, but let's go over to real problems where you can't. That E and that X don't mix. So the expectation is a problem, and computing X is a problem. And what has often been overlooked, I think, in the ADP community, because most of this community comes from, you know, state A or control U, but when you get to this X world of big vectors, the X and the E just don't mix. And that's actually a problem. So if I solve the state space problem, I still have that thing of an expectation inside my optimization algorithm. Okay, so I've got to be able to solve this. So here's one approach. So the classical ADP approach, I'll call it the textbook approach, with all apologies to the textbooks that are aging, and thanks to Dimitri's energy to keep something updated. I love his chapter that's downloadable on the internet. Please do that and put a link to that, because it's a wonderful chapter. So the classic style of solving this problem is to come over here for this value function. There's many, many ways to approximate it. Let's just keep it simple and assume we're doing something with basis functions. So I can come in here with basis functions, use whatever theory you want. Let's just assume that I've got some approximation using whatever your favorite technique is. But now what I've got is this problem where, okay, I've got an approximation for my value function. I still have the max with an E. Okay? So I'm not out of the woods yet at all. I can't solve that problem. Okay, give me whatever value function approximation you want. I still have a headache. So we're going to solve this using a neat little gimmick. And this is one of these things I realized after the fact. And, of course, I'm one of these people, and I think there's many of me, who sat down to solve a real-world problem, didn't know how to solve it, did something common sense, and then realized I was doing ADP. I didn't go from theory to practice. I went from, well, this is what humans are doing. Let me model that. Oh, gee, here's an intractable algorithm. And then I went through an ugly period of not knowing how to write that down on a sheet of paper. It was sort of an ad hoc heuristic type of approach. I found this device of a decision tree. Now, nobody would ever try to solve a fleet management problem using a decision tree, but let's take a peek at what they do here. Now, I'm going to assume everybody here knows decision trees. We have a state, often known as the decision node. We have an action. We have some random information, new state, new action, new information. We can solve it by taking expectations, rolling back through the decision tree. I'd like to assume, please smile and make me feel good, that we're all comfortable with what I just did. Okay? Now,
it should be turned the other way.
Not in the books I read. It goes down?
Yeah.
No, in the decision tree books I read, it goes like this. Okay. Thank you for your comments. Now, let's go take a look at what Bellman's equation does. Now, Bellman's equation starts at this thing, at the decision node, and rolls all the way forward to the next decision node. We go from ST to ST plus 1. Now, that's not how I solved the decision tree. See, I'm jumping, buried in this is the max and the expectation all together. Okay? So it maybe isn't surprising that that's kind of hard to do. When we actually saw the decision tree, we rolled from this node back to this node, back to this node, back to this node. And at each decision node, the problem I solved was deterministic. There wasn't an expectation in it. The expectation stuff had already been solved. Let's take a peek at that. So let me introduce some words. And this is one of these things where, so a little bit background of history. So here I was doing this, and I didn't really know how to model it. I didn't know the right words, but I knew what I was doing. And the one thing I was doing was that every time period, I was sitting there calling a linear programming package and solving a deterministic problem. So I'm sitting there going, I know I'm solving a deterministic problem. I even started writing Bellman's equation with the expectation outside the max operator. What really started to pull things together for me was a workshop in 2002 that Paul Werbos put together. And after the workshop, where for the first time I met the ADP community, ADPRL, there was the whole AI group, there was the whole IEEE group, and then Ben Van Roy and I were the only two representatives from operations research. Well, after that, they wanted an edited volume, and so I reached out to Ben and I said, I knew that I needed somebody to take a long, hard look at what I was doing, not just a casual, but to really look at it. And I arm-twisted Ben into co-authoring the chapter with me. And so he looked at what I was doing, and he says, well, I see what you're doing. We already call this thing the post-decision state variable. And as best I can tell, there's a paper written by Ben and Dimitri and John Tsitsikalos. I don't even know if you remember this paper. It's a minor conference proceedings paper on inventory theory. And in that paper, they used the word post-decision state. Well, as soon as I saw the word post-decision state, it was one of those things that says, I think that's the right word. Now, Andy in emails reminded me, well, okay, so there's you and Andy used the word after state variable. There's an economist out in Stanford, Ken Judd, who's got a wonderful book on numerical economics, who listened to my talk. He says, oh, that's the end of state variable. That there's no big deal here. Ben ran down some other references, found out, okay, so people have been using this idea since the 1950s, but every time you opened up a dynamic programming book, there was always the state, the predecision state, and you always had this Bellman equation with this expectation in the middle. Now, for many problems where you can compute the expectation or where the action space isn't very big, this isn't a big deal. But when you get these vectored valued action spaces and these messy expectations, it is a big deal. It's the showstopper. And so I started to say, well, let's use this concept of the post-decision state. Notice some notation that I'm doing. So ST is my traditional notation for state. I think this community likes to use it. The post-decision state, notice that it is indexed by T. It's measured at time t, the same point in time as this, but after a decision has been made. So since I'm an OR guy where decisions are x, I put an x up in the superscript. So there's no new information, which also means this is a deterministic function of s, okay, which is fairly key. Now, most people doing stochastic dynamic systems, by the way, I've had several opportunities to go at a community that says, what's your definition of a state variable? Let's not open up that particular bag of worms, but it is amazing how much difficulty we have defining a state variable. But we have an intuitive notion of what's a state variable. The post-decision state turns out to be one of those things that has people thinking. Let me do a bunch of examples. Now, very generically, if you're doing decision trees, you can think of two functions. If you go from decision node to outcome node, there's some function that does that. And it creates this thing called the outcome node, post-decision state. And then to go from outcome node to decision node, there's sort of a different function. Now, Q-learning, post-decision state is a state-action pair. That is mathematically a post-decision state. You can take the state, append it with an action, but it can be computationally a little awkward. This is more complicated than the pre-decision state. And here's something that my lab does a lot. We'll take the basic transition function, we'll take the random stuff and forecast it. We'll say, here's a forecast of what's going to happen. So this is what I think the state will be using what I know at time t. Okay? So this is a forecast of the state using. Now, sometimes we use this and sometimes we use this. Let me do some illustrations here. Simple inventory problem. I have an inventory R, certain amount of product. I order new product X, and then I have a random demand. Post-decision state is R plus X. From that gives you the post-decision state from post to pre is Rx minus the demand. Simple inventory problem. Tic-tac-toe. Okay, familiar territory for this community. So here's our tic-tac-toe board. There's my action. The state action pair is a kind of post-decision state. The state after the action is a post-decision state. That's what Rich and Andy would call the after state. The beauty of using the after state, the post state, is it gives you recursions where if you know the value of this, you can choose an action without having to figure out what's going on with that crazy expectation. Let's make things a little harder. Okay, so here's one of my trucking problems. Time is 40. I've got a truck driver who is coming inbound to Dallas. I expect him to arrive at time 41.2. His equipment looks like it's in good condition. What will a truck dispatcher do? He'll say, okay, as soon as that driver arrives, I'm going to sign him to this load going to Chicago. There's the decision. I'm going to send him to Chicago. So think of this as my tic-tac-toe board. Pre-decision state, there's my action. Now here's my post-decision state. Notice that it's still time 40. No time has passed. No new information. Nothing's random here. As far as I'm concerned, this truck, who, by the way, hasn't yet arrived at Dallas, as far as I'm concerned, this is a truck who will be in Chicago. I expect him to arrive at 54.7. Notice that's in continuous time. And I expect his truck to be in good condition. 10 hours later, he now is actually headed to Chicago. He's gotten stuck in traffic, and his onboard satellite communication says there's a problem with his engine that will require some maintenance when he arrives. So now, new information has arrived. This is a random variable at time 40. Okay. One last example. Resources and tasks. I got four drivers and three loads. I want to assign drivers to loads. That's my state. My action is to assign drivers to loads. I assign two drivers to two loads. Post-decision state. No time has passed. This is what's left over. Two drivers and one load. And my plan is to hold them, and I'll think about them in the future. No time has passed. That's the post-decision state. Roll the clock forward. New information arrives that was random at time two, at time T. Now here's my next pre-decision state, my next action, and so forth. I've even worked with students where we sit down, okay, we have to set up the post-decision state, and depending on the problem, sometimes I know exactly what to do, and sometimes it's, okay, I have to think about that. Designing the post-decision state and designing the value function approximation are a bit of an art. They take place at the same time. Now, what does that do for us? Here's the old Bellman's equation. This is the one I can't solve. The new Bellman's equation around the post-decision state is I've broken this into two pieces. This is a deterministic optimization problem, and here's that expectation stuff. Okay? Now, I still don't know what a value function is, so I'm going to come up here and take this deterministic optimization problem, replace this with a value function approximation, and if I choose my value function approximation well, remember x is some big vector, and I'm going to have to use some math programming package or algorithm. I'm going to have to use CPLEX or an integer programming solver or a nonlinear programming solver. Maybe I'm over here using my latest taboo search heuristic. Whatever your algorithm is, it's deterministic. And I've gotten rid of that expectation. This is huge.
So I can clarify something. So the post-decision state, so when you say, like, I think my truck is going to be there, I mean, do we have probability distributions over where the truck is going to be, or is that something...
Okay, so let me... Give me just a few more slides, and I'll show you how I'm going to handle that. Because I'm going to do Monte Carlo. So whether it's from a probability distribution or something observed, I'm going to assume a Monte Carlo sampling capability from that.
I think the foundation is that information about action and the pre-decision state should be capped in this post-decision state, and then you can always do this, right? You can always fabricate the post-decision state such that this works. As long as you keep all the information about the pre-decision state and the...
Sure. And all of my examples did that. And all my examples, so the most brute force way of doing that is a state action pair.
Yeah.
Okay? So you can always do that, but that actually makes the problem harder rather than easier. Most of the time, I have found something more compact. Okay?
The W is kind of like the unpredictable part.
That's the random variable.
So I saw a W bar in your.
Yes.
Does that mean you
That's a forecast. That's a forecast of W.
Somehow the trick you're doing in computing the expectation is saying, if I replace this W by its own expectation, then this gives me a deterministic trajectory, which is a good estimate of what the larger expectation is.
But I'm not going to assume that this actually happens. So I expect this state. The actual state that happens may be something random.
But your decision is based on that expectation. And then you live with the consequences of the sample pattern.
Yeah, but I do need to get to a couple more slides, and that may clarify things. Dimitri, did you want to?
Yeah, I wanted to ask if there's a single post-decision stage or several where you break down the decision in many pieces and you go from one post-decision stage to another post-decision stage.
I haven't done that. Not saying it couldn't be done. So let me I just got a few more slides that I think will sort of bring this together. So now, first of all, one is how do I approximate this? Now I'm going to go back to being an OR guy. And remember, OR people, we mainly manage resources. So when I do my value function, V-bar, around the post-decision, it's around the post-decision resource vector. So this is where my trucks, trains, planes, energy, money, blood is. And there's a lot of approximations you can use. Linear in my world does not mean linear in the parameters. It means linear in the resource. You know, five trucks is five times as good as one truck. That works in certain cases. This is the workhorse of my lab, piecewise linear separable. This is what I do over and over again, and my industrial projects, I'll illustrate it. But it doesn't always work. And, of course, this is now where you're saying, okay, you know, open up the door and in comes the machine learning community. There's all kinds of tricks and techniques that we can use, one of which is this thing called Bender's Cuts, which is, again, very well known in the OR community. There's a lot of people in stochastic optimization who use this. The only reason I don't use it is, well, there's two reasons. One is a lot of my problems are discrete resources, and this is hard to work with discrete resources. But the second thing is I had trouble with higher dimensional resource vectors. But there's a whole pile of techniques. This is the technique I'm starting to look at because of that crazy row. Remember that state of the world? In my energy modeling, the value of having more wind turbines depends on whether there's a carbon tax. And so that features is what captures that. Now, let me try to compare sort of three fundamental methods of updating value functions. This is value iteration, textbook value iteration. Assume I can compute the expectation right out of Ron Howard's book. Here's my old estimate of the value function for all states. Solve this problem for each state and get a new value function. Okay, that's textbook value iteration. What I'll call classical ADP around the pre-decision state, notice that I've got that one-step transition matrix. I've got that expectation. All right. What I'm going to do is I'm going to use V hat as my Monte Carlo sample of the value being in a state and use it to update V bar around the state variable. Okay? And if you do this, you've got to deal somehow with some expectation up there. However you're going to do it, you're going to have to sweat that. What I've been doing is saying, let's take the V hat, which is my Monte Carlo estimate of the value being in a state, and update the value function around the previous post-decision state. Now, this updating, now, of course, this 1 minus alpha times old V plus alpha times new V, I'm doing this as a placeholder. You do your recursively squares. You do whatever updating scheme you want to do. That's not the point here. The point here is using this information to update the value around the previous one. Now, even though I may do a forecast, I don't always, I sometimes may do a forecast, it's still a Monte Carlo estimate. I'm not assuming a forecast comes true, okay? I'm doing the same sample, Monte Carlo sample pass that everybody else is doing. So the updating here has not changed. What I'm updating has changed. By changing what I update, I've gotten rid of the expectation. Now I've got my deterministic problem, and I can go use my math programming packages. This is the trick. Okay? So if I could break down the problem, quick question?
I was going to say, at one level, it's a lot like Q-learning.
Okay, so take a look at this. Mathematically, this is a function of a state-action pair. Mathematically, okay? Mathematically, that's a Q factor. So the question is, when is it mathematically different and when is it computationally different? So mathematically, you could say, well, this is all cue learning. It's the computation that's different, I think. And the problem is, what people write on a sheet of paper and what people do inside their code, we all understand there's a gap there. Okay? And so there's the, here's what I wrote on my paper, but of course we all know that we code it this way. Like a lot of people will write a one-step transition matrix, but they don't actually mean you're using a one-step transition matrix. They just write it that way. So this is a challenge, that for, especially for someone like me who came to this community later in life. I had to learn a lot of what I've learned from textbooks and whatnot. You know, I was very grateful for the various conferences I've gone to and many conversations, because what you see on a sheet of paper and what people are actually doing isn't always the same. So I could easily have Rich coming in and saying, yeah, but that's basically what we do. The thing is, it's this gap between computation and theory. We can write down an equation on a sheet of paper. Five different people go take that equation, go solve different problems, they're doing totally different things. So is it really different than Q learning? It depends on what you mean by a Q factor. If a Q factor is a table lookup state action pair, this is really different. If a Q factor is any function of state and action, well, there's a function of state and action. But I'm not estimating Q S of X, I'm estimating V bar of post-decision state. And I think computationally that's different. So the basic steps is we have a deterministic optimization problem. For me, this is some sort of solver. And I don't do anything fancy here. I just call commercial solvers and solve my problem. I'm big industrial strength transportation companies. I'm calling commercial solvers. Down here is just basic simulation. This is a placeholder. I don't literally do this. This is the placeholder that says, okay, guys, get ready for learning a lot about machine learning. Okay? And so if we take this basic problem here, this is my optimization problem here and now. Those are my value functions. Then I've got my machine learning part and the statistical estimation. Now, I've got to apologize for this slide, but I couldn't resist slipping this in. So you have to understand the R community. We have dynamic programmers. We have stochastic programmers. But in terms of real practical work, there's two big sub-communities. Optimization, simulation, they don't talk to each other. Okay? And so I was doing a sales pitch for my book, and please don't laugh, or you can laugh. It's okay to laugh. I said, well, you know, what approximate dynamic programming doing is, this is the community that brings these two fields together. And so I did this cute little slide. So I was invited last fall to give a talk in Italy, and I said, okay, I can't resist a trip to Italy. And it turned out it was in a course where they had two professors. One a deterministic optimization professor, the other a stochastic simulation professor. And it was so cute. I learned over dinner that night that they were married. I just thought that was neat. Anyway, so let me walk through an actual example, because math means nothing. Let's actually do a real problem and do it all with pictures. Blood management. Okay, so this is a nice, clean problem. You have eight types of blood, you have supplies of blood, demands for blood. There's eight blood types. At any one point in time, I have a state which is my inventory of blood, the people who need blood. I solve a linear program, small linear program, to match them up. These are all the substitutions. You know, if you happen to know your blood type, you can see O minus is the universal donor, AB positive is the universal recipient. Everybody else has to pick and choose. Now, I have to decide what blood types to use right now. Then I'm going to have new donations of blood, new people coming in needing blood, have a new problem, have to do this over and over again. Now I want to think about what blood types do I want to use now versus hold off now, because I may need them in the future. So I want to now optimize over time. Now here's a nice linear program at a point in time. All the solid arcs are here and now, and all the dotted arcs have to do with thinking about the future. So I'm going to assume I have various penalties and bonuses. Over here we have AB positive blood. The number here is how old is the blood. Blood can be up to 5 weeks old. And once it hits the 6th weeks, you have to throw it out. So what I'm going to now do is, I don't really care about the here and now stuff. Here's my random demand for blood of a particular type, not by age, it's just a particular blood type. I don't have that labeled right. Anyway, forget that. I'm going to shrink that all down into one little box here so we can just think about what is the value of holding blood for the future. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, let's approximate the value of blood as piecewise linear separable value function. And you're going to see this over and over again. This is the workhorse of my lab. So for every type of blood, I'll have a piecewise linear value function for the value of blood of each of these types. Now, I'm going to transform that into an equivalent network representation. This is one big linear program. Well, not very big linear program. There's about 200 decision variables or 300 decision variables in this. This is a nice small linear program. So we can think of it as, oh my gosh, we have a control variable with 300 dimensions, but as a linear program, this is a toy. Okay, this is something you can easily do. Now, here's something else I get from the L linear program. I not only get an optimal solution, I get dual variables. I get the marginal value of each type of these bloods. Let's call those V hat. Now, before V hat was the value of being in a state. When you do resource allocation, we're not so much interested in values as we are interested in marginal values. The ADP community has words like dual dynamic programming, dual heuristic dynamic programming. So this is working with derivatives. And notice I don't just get one derivative, I get a derivative for every one of these for free. I get it just from my LP code. Now, what I can do is let's call everything this blue, this is the LP, let's call it all F of R. If I were to take one of the inputs, two-week-old AB positive blood, if I were to resolve this LP for all different values of this, I'm going to get a piecewise linear function. Let's say I've got 42 units of blood. The marginal value is roughly, I've got one of these non-differentiable things, I get roughly a slope. This is my dual variable. Now, let's say I have 42 units of blood on hand. I had 12 units donated the previous week. I ended the previous week with 30 units of blood. So here's 30. Here's the 12 units that were added, so to bring me up to my 42. What I'm going to now do, watch carefully, is I'm going to take this V hat, which is the marginal value of additional unit of blood when I have 42, and I'm going to now bring this back to the blue value function, which is around the previous post-decision state. I'm going to now use this slope to update this slope. I'll do smoothing and get an updated value function approximation around the previous post-decision. We okay with that? Now, that's a very special update for this problem class. It's one that we use a lot. What we'll do is we optimize this. You've seen this. We iterate forward in time. Every time I'm iterating, I'm getting all these dual variables. I'm updating my piecewise linear value function approximation. By the way, you may pick up, in OR, we have a lot of resource allocation problems where if I'm maximizing, they're concave. Concavity is huge. Concavity is a great trick. So what we do is we learn this, and we get very stable performance, very stable convergence. In the best of worlds, this is an actual problem, we get a very nice convergence like this. I wish they all look like that. They don't. Sometimes they look kind of messy and ugly and bouncy. This is actually more typical. And you're doing well if it tends to get better. More on that later. What's my timing? Should be done by 12:30? Okay. I'm going to skip through a pile of slides here. This would have been fun to talk about. I want to get to some of my applications. Here's my trucking application. So after 20 years, they finally gave us a project. They have about 7,000 drivers. These are the drivers. These are the loads. At any time, we have to assign driver's loads. At a point in time, I get an LP with about 20,000 variables. This is what I'm trying to simulate. I'm not trying to optimize them. I'm trying to simulate them. What they want is a model that mimics the collective intelligence of this room full of people. And it took us about 3 years. This was a hard project. Even with all this stuff, it still took a lot to calibrate. They gave us about 12 statistics. And they would give us sort of like, here's a max min, you have to fall within the range. And the range was kind of tight. So it wasn't easy. It took us a little while to get there. But one of the questions I came up with was, okay, cool, but how much did ADP actually help? Was dynamic programming actually played a role? Here's one statistic. Again, we're not trying to maximize. They gave us a statistic, average length of haul for team drivers. And they wanted us to be in that gray range. And if we just ran a vanilla simulator, it doesn't get any better or worse. It just sits there. And as we optimize, behind the scenes there is an objective function, which did tend to get better. But what happened was that statistic became more realistic. And we have a number of these where for us to optimize this problem, we ended up with something that was very realistic. And you have to understand, this is a massive paradigm shift for my community. Even today, I struggle with people going, well, what are you doing here? Is this a simulator or are you optimizing? Don't you want to optimize? We don't want to mimic the stupid decisions they make on the floor. Most OR people, they set up simple models and optimize them, and then they don't ever attempt to calibrate. Well, if you actually try to calibrate it, once you have a really realistic model, if you can do the best you can to optimize, you tend to be doing as well as that room full of people. And that's a big paradigm shift for my community. The value another test, the value function says, well, let's take Texas drivers of a certain type. As we increase the number of those drivers, we get this nice nonlinear function. I'd love to know the slope of that function to know how many Texas-based drivers, drivers whose home is in Texas. The dynamic programming gives me that slope for all 500 domiciles from one run of the model. Okay? That blue line, I had to do all those numbers, and I would have to do that 500 times. We did a lot of statistical tests to say, well, if I brute force the number, I get this confidence interval. The purple bars are from the dynamic programming. One run of the model, we get these. Schneider is now using this to guide where they hire drivers. This was an actual plot that says, hey, guys, this is where you really want more drivers. This is where the drivers are most valuable. This is where the drivers are least valuable. Kind of interesting that was down around the coast. You know, the U.S. has this little immigration problem. So, and they looked at that and they said, wow, that's great. Let us know if you know any drivers in that region. So maybe they have some now. This was a few years ago. This paper literally just appeared a few days ago. So even though this work goes back years, the papers are just now coming out. We have a rail application for optimizing locomotives. You have locomotives and trains. You may need more than one locomotive to pull a train. The locomotives are different. In the future, you have to put them into different buckets. We'll have a nonlinear value function, the value of each type of locomotive. This was a case where piecewise linear separable didn't work. And we had to bring these together in sort of an aggregate. And so we used nested piecewise linear value functions. This is an actual animation from a graphic package we have where we simulate forward, communicate backwards, simulate forward. As we're doing this, we're updating value functions. This is now being used as a planning system by Norfolk Southern. This is what took us years. I hate to say how many hours went into this. What we did is we varied the fleet size. We get a certain statistic, and it was a real killer. We finally nailed history. That's history. That's what they actually did. That was their actual fleet size and their actual delay. Because we couldn't cheat. They really wanted this to be accurate. This was a whole new data set. This was history. Notice, not quite on the line, but they now say, okay, that's now our planning model for planning locomotives. We did some work with a multi-agent, and by the way, this is used. You don't have one person running all of Norfolk Southern Railroad. You have desks. This is the Southeast desk. This is the Northeast desk. That's the Midwest desk. And they really do break this problem into regions. And what we can do is have blue is one region, purple is a different region. And this is how we actually model it. We model it by how they actually solve the problem. And I like to call this modeling the organization flow of information decisions. Huge paradigm shift for the OR community. They don't do this. Okay. Here is an actual plot of where we broke it down by desk. We call it the desk model. This is where we do a global system optimization. We can say that system is better. That's cool. But this is the one that calibrated. That's the one that calibrated. That's the one that matched history. And I have a wonderful energy application, but I think I'm out of time. We have done a model where we have 200,000 time periods. Everything's continuous rather than discrete, and that's got a whole new set of applications for us. Within a few weeks, I'll finish up a paper on this if you're interested in my energy model. And again, piecewise linear separable value function approximations. It's amazing how robust this is. It doesn't always work, but we're on a great roll. I have a very final slide at the end, but because I can't get to it.
I'll wait 5 minutes to see the energy application. It sounds good.
Sure. I can go real quick. Should I give you the 2 minute run through? We're doing an energy planning model where every year we have to make energy investments. This is how much I have, this is how much I invest, this is random stuff. And this happens in all different types of energy technologies. When we go out 20 years, we'll have yearly energy investment decisions, but we really have to deal with the intermittence of wind and solar. And wind, if you average wind, if you use average wind over a year, that is the killer energy. That'll dominate everything. Wind doesn't blow at its average. It fluctuates. And so you get all kinds of messy fluctuations that varies sub-minute, minute, hourly, and seasonally. This is a seasonal variation in California. There is a windy season in California. But if you come in and use average wind, even at a daily level, it looks dramatically better than when you get it down to even the hourly level. We have various types of storage devices. So one thing is that wind can fluctuate upward and you can store it, but then you have to model storage. So to get an accurate modeling of energy investment, you have to know the marginal value of wind. To know the marginal value of wind, you have to know it in the presence of these hourly fluctuations and in the presence of storage. So let's say this is a hourly dispatch problem of supply and demand. This is a small linear program. There's my hydroelectric storage. And as I walk forward in time, I have storage. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to model the value of energy in storage with a piecewise linear value function approximation. You sort of get the software doing this, the same software running my trucking companies. Now, let me call this a linear program. Let me shrink it down. So when you see that, that's like an hourly LP dispatch problem, very small. What we're going to do is model hour one, hour two, all the way through time, 8,760 hours. And we're going to do that for each year for the next 20 years. And, of course, all through this, I'm going to keep track of all my storage, because as I walk forward in time, I can keep track of storage. Now, here's the challenge. Once a year, I have to make an energy investment decision. I may have a certain number of wind turbines that I can hold, but I may want to purchase new wind turbines, and the number I will purchase will depend on a piecewise linear value function approximation. Now I roll forward. Now I have to roll forward through the year, all 8,760 hours, given the investments I've already made in previous years. I have to live with what I started at the beginning of the year. Roll forward to the next year, make the same energy decisions, roll forward the 8,760. Here's the hard part. What I'm going to have to do now is to stop and get the marginal value of additional wind turbines. And I get this just from the dual variables. And I use those dual variables to update my piecewise linear value functions. Again, I'm just using the same library here. So now what I'm going to be doing is rolling forward 20 years in hourly increments, about 200,000 hours. Now there's two ways, and then I do this iteratively, standard ADP type logic. It turns out a year's worth of simulation of linear programs takes about 5 seconds. So this takes about 2 to 3 minutes to go out 20 years, and I have to do 100 iterations or so. So we're talking about 3 to 4 hours of time, not doing anything fancy on the computer. So the runtimes aren't super fast, but they're quite manageable. Over the iterations, we'll estimate these piecewise linear functions. Anything that constrains the system is a resource. Energy investments, energy and storage. Anything time there's a constraint, that's a piecewise linear value function. Solving lots of really baby linear programs, which the CPLEX handles very easily. We have done some testing where I say, you know what? I can get the optimal solution to this if I assume everything's deterministic. Well, ADP can solve a deterministic problem. It doesn't have to be stochastic. And I can compare them. So here's one test that I did. We did two types of tests. We did over 1 year, 8,760 hours, and we focused on how well we matched the LP model in terms of holding energy in the water reservoir. And when we did a 20-year problem, deterministically, you cannot solve a 20-year problem using an LP package. LP package cannot handle 200,000 time periods. ADP can't. LP can't. Deterministic. Make everything deterministic. Let's get rid of the stochastic bugaboo, okay? So we're getting within 0.06%, but here is the real test. This is the water in the reservoir. This is my rainfall, deterministic. This is my demand. For this one, it's just constant. I'll change it in a second. This is the optimal reservoir. Take a look at this. Now watch closely. This is optimal for a linear program, and the dynamic programming solution is this. I wish to say this was easy. No, it wasn't. Linear program, ADP. Here's a linear program where I did a sinusoidal demand, optimal from linear program, optimal from ADP. Again, I wish to say this was easy. It's not, but it looks like it's working. We can do stochastic rainfall. With stochastic rainfall, I build up the reservoir early, deterministically, and the energy community is full of people who like to take a whole sample path and optimize over the whole sample path. It is amazing how many papers are out there doing that. Okay, modern papers, recent papers. This is a community that doesn't know how to do stochastic optimization. So that's my energy. Oh, so I got to my last slide. So I love this. Earlier this year, Andy and I were sort of emailing back and forth, and Andy, I hope you don't mind, but he put in this great quote that I had to repeat. It says, he said, Warren, I think you give too rosy a picture of ADP. What he was trying to say was, so there was this paper that's about to come out, I think it comes out in a month or two, where I talked about merging AI and OR. And, you know, I'm like, oh, wow, look at all this great stuff. I mean, you can see I've got a lot of cool problems. And he's like, well, you know, Warren, tone things, let's be careful with expectations. And he's right. ADP is not a magical, boy, you plug it in. I know so many people who've tried ADP, oh, that didn't work, okay, because they never got over the hump. It's not easy. Even in a problem class, and all my big stuff is, it's big, but it's not anywhere near as complicated as some of the problems, many of the problems worked on by this community. They're just big. Big doesn't mean they're hard, okay? So it's nice to have a problem class where this stuff works, but I do have certain properties like concavity and other nice things. This is the very, very last section of my book that in effect acknowledges this. That, yeah, if you can get it working, patent it. That's an invention. Because there's a lot of ADP. We love the good theory. And by the way, I am a strong supporter that as much as you can learn the theory, try to learn the theory. It really is a good foundation. We are a huge consumer of Dimitri's work in my lab. We do a lot of theorem proving. I had to skip through that. But the simple fact is we've got the theory, we've got the laboratory experiments, field stuff that really works. It took me many years. I haven't had the easiest career. Things are starting to work. Some of my papers coming out, I mean, they're just coming out. So it's not like, oh, yeah, I've got this 1992 paper where I was a hero. No, the real success stories are just now coming out, where things are finally really working. And a lot of it is due to the theoretical work of my grad students. We have leveraged very heavily the work in Rich and Andy's book, and very much the theoretical work in the newer DP book is a foundation of my lab. Thank you for the extra time.
Well, you really should go to lunch.
I'll let you. Well, this is totally problem dependent, but we have problems where we'll have several hundred thousand value functions. Okay, but this is very problem dependent.
So I guess for your class of problems, it turns out that the number remains manageable, and then you can prove that, or otherwise at least.
Okay, when you get to the industrial stuff, we stop proving things. The proof is that this model actually matches history. Okay, and the companies that have sponsored us. They don't want to see the model unless we match. So they are a very high plateau to hit what they want us to do. And so like at Schneider National, we have a 15-dimensional attribute vector. The value of a driver in the future is only 3-dimension, but it still gives us 600,000 parameters to estimate. And we had to do our own research to help us over some of those hurdles. Real quick.
So you talked about the calibration issue. So you are using simulated models. And so what is the objective function that you're trying to use?
Okay. Well, we have three objective functions in my lab, which we call F, G, and H. So F is what the algorithm uses. G is management goals. And H is what we call user happiness. Okay. And the company, if we tell them that we're getting a better objective function, they could care less. They do care about metrics, the goals. And then what they'll do is, like the locomotive people, they actually have dispatchers that look at what we're doing and say, no, we don't do that. And we call it user happiness. And in an actual, that sounds sort of cute and silly, but we've had projects where we go into the field on an operational model and we actually match how many times they implement a decision we recommend. I mean, we can turn that into a formal metric. So it's roughly, at this level, management wants to say, did I get certain metrics? At this level, operations will say, are you actually doing what I would do?
So do you use parametric models, and then you are tuning the parameters of the models?
So buried in our model are a whole pile of knobs. Okay, penalty for drivers getting home, you know, bonuses for picking a load up. And so, yes, there is a messy utility function, and one of the key things here is that here's what they really want out of ADP. They want to specify utility function, have the ADP algorithm optimize it. Okay, so that if you put a bigger bonus on this thing over here, they want to see more of that activity happening. So you really do need optimizing behavior. But they're going to be going over here and saying, okay, we're doing too much of this and too little of this. Let's tweak the parameters. And then we come over here. We definitely want that ADP algorithm to be doing true optimization, because that's the only way that if you tune this knob over here, you get the right behavior over here.
Do you expose the shadow prices to the clients so that they can do tuning for resource reallocation?
So in the case of Schneider, we literally use the value functions, which are just smooth dual variables. And they do use that to guide where they should hire drivers. Now, we don't have stories like that on all the projects, but that was one for that project. They really wanted those marginal values, and they wanted the marginal value to match a brute force simulation that says, well, what if we just throw in 20 extra drivers and we simulate, and then look at how much the simulation changes. They want the two to match. I think people need to get to lunch.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.